Hard years can include, and almost universally always include, the startup year. So we expect you to have a loss year one. Like, a lot of artists are like, feel a lot of guilt or shame that they don't make money at first. Neither does Uber. Neither did that restaurant you ate dinner at last night. That's normal. You're not a bad guy. It's completely normal.
Welcome to the Passionate Painter Podcast. I'm your host, Caroline Italia Carlson. Whether your art is a full-time career or your side gig, if you are passionate about creating art, this podcast is for you. Don't worry about taking notes. I'll do that for you. And you can find them at PassionatePainterPodcast.com. Don't forget, my portrait painting masterclass, The Portrait Code, is now available at PassionatePainterAcademy.com. I created this course for all the painters who tell me they can paint other things, but they just can't paint portraits. This course shows you how to approach painting portraits to get a great start, even if you're scared. And it shows you how to assess your progress and get back on track when you've gotten in the weeds. And if you're feeling insecure about any of the fundamentals, such as mastering the elements of design, composition, perspective, anatomy, color theory, or mixing skin tones, I've got you covered. There's a robust module on each, in addition to a complete portrait demonstration and an 8-lesson module on confidence. Learn more at PassionatePainterAcademy.com. And if you happen to be one of the people who says, "That sounds great, Caroline, but it just won't work for me," I invite you to send me an email at Caroline@PassionatePainterPodcast.com. I'd be happy to chat with you about where you're at in your portrait journey. And if you like, look at one of your portraits together to figure out where you may want to focus to take your skills to the next level, whether or not you purchase my course. Again, you can reach me at Caroline@PassionatePainterPodcast.com. Welcome to part two of my interview in progress with American artist and tax expert to creatives, Hannah Cole. If you haven't yet listened to part one, you'll definitely want to circle back and catch that as well, as it focuses on Hannah's success as a fine artist who's shown her work both in the U.S. and abroad. You can find part one at PassionatePainterPodcast.com/episode 72. I'm repeating Hannah's bio here as well for your convenience. Hannah Cole is a tax expert who specializes in working with creative people and their businesses. Though she's worked with a couple of buttoned-up tax firms in New York, she loves bringing her tax skills to the aid of the creative world. Her passion for helping creative businesses began when she was an account executive and interactive producer for a New York interactive design agency, where she saw the struggles and triumphs from the inside. A longtime working artist with a high-level exhibition history, the financial challenges of freelancers and small creative businesses are both relevant and personal to Hannah. And she knows that describing tax concepts in jargon-free language is always a good thing. Hannah delivers engaging tax education that is art world savvy and empowering. She's not just a numbers person. She's an artist, too. Hannah regularly gives workshops and appears as a guest on podcasts. So turning back to the subject of taxes, what would you say, because we're anticipating success in selling pieces and having money coming in, What's the most important thing artists need to know about paying taxes?
Well, I think one of the really important things to know is it's very important to track your numbers, track your income, and track your expenses, because actually, it is your legal obligation to report all of your income. Like, when I say it's your legal obligation, like, it's a felony if you don't. So it's like they really mean it.
My listeners are going, "Oh my God."
I know. So it's your legal obligation to track all your income. So you have to be doing that. The IRS is not sympathetic if you do not. If you miss a chunk, then they'll be like, "Hey, we have some serious consequences for you." But the cool thing, and I like to do a little thought reversal on this, I think a lot of us get into this mindset of like, "Oh God, bookkeeping, yuck. Like, I don't want to set that up. What a pain. I don't want to track that stuff." here's the thing. You don't have to. Like, if you want to go ahead and overpay your taxes, you are completely free to. There's no problem. If you don't want to bother keeping receipts and like tracking your expenses, the IRS is so completely happy to take more of your money than you actually owe. It's fine. I want to tell you, bookkeeping is self-care. Bookkeeping is something you do for yourself. So you pay taxes just on your profit and not on gross income, which legally you have to report all of. So you are a small business when you're an artist. It's good to know that. It's actually very important to know that. Being a small business, there's only one thing that defines you as that, and that is the fact that you have a profit motive. And just to get into that as a sidebar, that is a really big deal. And it's really easy in the art world to almost talk yourself out of the fact that you have one. Because, you know, we live in a culture as artists where we're not really supposed to talk about that super overtly. You would never walk into a gallery and be like, I want to sell my paintings for maximum dollar. You know, tell me what's the most popular color. That's what I'm going to make all my paintings. Like, we don't talk that way. And you're not in it for that, right? You want to make work that speaks to the soul and has a higher purpose. But it's okay to want to make sales, and you should. And the thing is that the IRS, the only thing they care about, the only thing that makes you a business and not a hobby is the fact that you're trying to make money. So it's really important to know, okay, you don't have to talk about it in this sort of crass way in the gallery world or among your artist friends. But when you're looking at your books, when you're doing your taxes, when you're approaching the IRS or your state taxing authority, you have to make sure you do have a profit motive. You're only a business if you're trying to make money. So it's okay. It's okay. Like, let's get into the headspace where that's fine. It's okay to make money.
So. It is. And that, I think, ties right into the permission that you give yourself to want to get out of the starving artist mode. You have to cross that threshold of permission in your own mind first.
Absolutely. Yes.
And that's a good question in that I've been keeping records of my expenses for years. And mm-hmm. what I find, because I've not completely transitioned into full-time just for my fine art. I'm still doing some marketing work on the side and some commercial stuff. But what I find is that from year to year, my expenses seem large to me, but they don't always meet the threshold of writing off the deductions. And my accountant will sometimes say, well, I'll just take the standard deductions.
Ooh, can I stop you?
Yeah, please do. Because I'm wondering, like, should I just keep the receipts in case I get audited, but not deal with them unless I do, because he's always taken the standard. Why do I even have to do the paperwork?
I want to stop you right here because this is a really common misconception. You are not alone. The standard deduction has nothing to do with your business, nothing to do. Okay. So do not throw away those receipts. They're not related. So the standard deduction means you don't itemize. So you don't itemize, and that's fine. Itemizing is mortgage interest, charitable contributions, medical expenses, and state and local taxes. Notice I never said anything about your art deductions in there. That's not what itemized deductions are. So you don't itemize, great. You don't have mortgage interest, state and local tax, medical expenses, and charitable contributions that are higher than the standard deduction. So fine. But that has nothing to do with your Schedule C business expenses, which you are completely entitled to under any circumstance, so long as you have a profit motive. And that is the only factor. Do you have a profit motive? If you do, keep the receipts, you get the expenses.
Okay. So I think what confused me then was that he must have been referring to my taxes as filing jointly as a married person, because I file with my husband, but then I also file a Schedule C for myself. So maybe he was referring to that with regard to standard deductions and the business with regard to the Schedule C, because I do give him itemized everything.
I want to steer you away from using that word itemized, because they're not itemized deductions. Just call them business deductions.
Okay.
I only say this for the clarity of your audience.
No, and I need to know what the difference there is.
Yeah. So again, itemized deductions, charitable contributions, mortgage interest, state and local taxes, medical expenses. That's itemizing. Your business deductions are over here, unrelated, and they're completely yours, whether you itemize or not. Right. So you cannot itemize, but still take your business deductions.
Okay.
That's the key.
Thank you. That's good.
Yeah. And even to make it more clear, itemized deductions go into Schedule A, business deductions, Schedule C, two separate schedules, no relationship.
Okay.
Yeah. So you don't have a Schedule A. Fine. You still get your Schedule C.
So it's still worth it for me to keep all those lists, all those records and receipts.
For sure. For sure. Okay. Now, something that does come up with artists, and this could be something your accountant has talked about with you, possibly. This will, you know, many of your listeners will, when I say this, they'll be like, oh, yeah. We've talked about that. It's the issue of losses in your business. This is an unfortunate symptom of, you know, an art world where artists are not always paid, even when they're doing professional work, or not paid enough or consistently enough. And so we often have losses even when we are professionals with a profit motive. And I think a lot of people make the mistake of assuming that means they don't really have a business or it's not a real business. And that's not true. You can even look for yourself. Don't take my word for it. Go look at the title of the Schedule C. The title says profit or loss from business activities. It does not say profit only. And a loss is truly, truly valid, truly okay to take in your practice. But what happens, and a loss is actually a tax benefit to you. It shelters other income on your tax return. And the purpose of that, just because, you know, we don't even get a civic education in taxes in this country, which is bananas.
Yeah.
Because it's a mandatory civic duty.
But my listeners have heard me rant.
So have mine. But the role of a loss and the reason that it's allowed and the reason that it's a benefit is because you are a genuine business and businesses have hard years and the government is literally giving you a tax benefit for hard years. So hard years can include and almost universally always include the startup year. So we expect you to have a loss year one. Like a lot of artists are like, feel a lot of guilt or shame that they don't make money at first. Neither does Uber. Neither did that restaurant you ate dinner at last night. That's normal. You're not a bad guy. That's completely normal. If you even think about the framework here, a business cannot make money from its own operations until it exists, right? Doesn't that sound obvious?
Yeah.
We don't think of it that way. Like a pizza parlor can't make money from selling pizzas until it has an oven, until it has flour, right? And how does it get an oven? How does it get flour? It can't get that yet from selling pizzas. It needs that money coming from somewhere else. And that's going to be a loss for a while. So there's this whole thing in business. This is one of the sort of miracles of actually going back to school and studying business and economics and accounting that I'm so thrilled to bring to artists. But like, there's this whole concept in business of the break-even point. In other words, it's a completely accepted principle of operating any business, and you are included in this, all of you artists listening, that you're going to be running at a loss for a while, like for a while as you get started. And then you hit this magical moment called the break-even point. That's where your expenses and your income equal zero, right? You're in the negative until that. And then we're like, woohoo, now we start going positive. And that's the fun part. Like, amen, let's all get there.
Amen.
That's important to know.
So now, is this true that if you don't show a profit 3 years running, if you're showing losses, that you get downgraded to a hobby level?
Okay. So here's where all of your accountants are wrong and I'm right. I'm going to really put my flag in the ground right now.
Go for it.
Yeah. So I can say this because I read the case law for artists and your accountant doesn't. Sorry. I'm being a snob right here. But here's the thing. So there's a guideline called the hobby loss rule that basically the thing about having a loss in your business, some people have abused the fact that a loss creates a tax shelter, right? So there are people in the world right now filing tax returns with Schedule C's with losses on them so that they pay less income tax than they should rightfully be paying. And they'll put things on there like their horse farm, which they're doing because they love horses and they have a lot of money and they just, you know, and they're going to pretend it's a business, or their charter fishing boat and they're going to call it a business, you know, occasionally take someone out, right? So these things that people do for fun, they put on Schedule C's and fake it and have a loss and get a tax shelter, right? And there are people maybe doing art who do this too, right? Hobbyist artists who do this too. But the problem is, you can't tell from a tax return alone who the faker is, who the abusive loss is, and who the real business is, who's just not broken even yet, or who had a terrible year. I mean, what performing artist didn't have a loss year during COVID when all their shows were canceled? Like, that's not because you're a hobby. You didn't suddenly become a hobby. COVID happened. So it can happen without your control. But the problem is that the IRS, from the numbers, the tax return is just the cliff notes. It's not War and Peace. And so they can only, from reading the cliff notes of the tax return, those two tax returns, the fake one and the real one, they look the same. And so the only tool the IRS really has to tell the difference is to audit one or both of those people and examine whether or not they have a profit motive. So artists, big tip here, capture your profit motive. Like, anything that shows your profit motive is something you should keep in your records. And that is any advertising, your website, grant applications, correspondence with people who are in a position to show your work, and basically anything you do that isn't fun. Because I literally mean that. If you hate doing it, it's proof you're a business. Literally, because hobbyists don't do the not fun stuff. Like, if you're doing the bookkeeping, if you're collecting a, you know, list on MailChimp and sending emails, you're a business. So, but the hobby loss rule, just to get back to this thread, is that it's a way, it's like a little sort of rule of thumb that the IRS has to determine, without having to talk to you, because that costs money. So by just looking at data they already have to make a judgment about if you're a hobby or a business. So the hobby loss rule says, if you have had a profit in 3 out of the last consecutive 5 tax years, the presumption, note, presumption, not definitive, absolute, the presumption is that you're running a business, right? So then what it means, does that mean you can't be audited? Absolutely not. If you have a pulse and a tax return, you can be audited. But what it means, if they do, burden of proof is on the IRS. They have to prove you don't have a profit motive. Now, you can go the other way. And here's where the other accountants are wrong. Here's where your accountant is wrong. What happens if you don't have a profit in 3 out of the last 5 years, so you have more losses than that, it simply shifts the burden of proof. That is all. That is all it does. So same as any tax year, you can still be audited because you always can. That's our only check and balance in this system. So that is fair. But then the burden of proof is on you. So now you have to prove, the presumption is you're running a hobby, and you now have to prove with documents that you're running a business.
If you get audited.
If you get audited, and only if, yes.
Okay.
And
thank
it's important.
You.
It's really important to know there is case law, and I'll cite it for you right here so you can have a record of it. Churchman versus Commissioner and Kreil versus Commissioner, 2 artists, both of whom had like 18 years of losses and successfully proved that they were businesses. Tell that to your accountant when they say you're a hobby.
Put that in your pipe and smoke it.
Say, take a look at Kreil versus Commissioner.
How do you spell Kreil with a C?
C-R-I-L-E. And if you go to my blog, I did a 3-hour interview with Susan Kreil, and I wrote an article about her case because it's really interesting. And her suffering gave us more ammunition in our pocket, more fuel. So she did a real service to other artists by going through the ordeal that she went through.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I think that possibly, like me, when you hear that hobby loss rule, that you start to think, well, if I don't produce a profit in 3 years, you know, after 3 consecutive years, I have to shut my business down and I can't be in business and I'm not a real artist.
That's a tragedy. That's not true. And I want you to know it's not true. Yeah.
Because you may be making your art on the side, and it's maybe you're making money, but some of the money you're making is from a side gig, you know? So in other words, even if you're not, it's not a measure of your worth as an artist.
Absolutely not. Oh my goodness. No. So, and also, I mean, if you get audited, like it can feel like a punch in the gut. It can really feel like the IRS is saying, like, you're not real. You're not a good artist. And trust me, they could care less. Like, they're not in it for the art. They care about the money. Like, literally the only thing they care about is like the dollar signs on the file.
Like, yes.
They're not saying like, you're a good painter.
Well, and this, I think this ties in with a lot of people's fear about dealing with their finances, personal finance in general, especially I think artists, because now I'm stereotyping, but as far as being someone that is more maybe empathic, or not that other people aren't, but a lot of artists are. And so the feeling kind of personality where we are making that tie between our value and the numbers, and getting better at my finances had a lot to do, especially as an empath, with making that line and saying, it's just numbers, it's not personal. Instead of, if you're worried about being able to pay the bills, because underneath you're worried about what it means about you and your worth, a person may not look at their bank account when they absolutely need to go check if, you know, a check cleared or a payment was made. And I find that there's an avoidance there with artists sometimes, and anyone, that they're afraid to look. And it's because of this underlying emotional association with their value. So making it not personal is a good thing when it comes to money. And it's numbers. It has nothing to do with your value.
Absolutely. And if I may expand on that.
Please.
I think, and this is why I felt so humiliated when I sat with that, with my dad's accountant, you know, many, many, many years ago, and crystallized my thought of like, how can this not be better than this? So what, I don't know any artist who goes into art because they want to become a millionaire. I mean, that's pretty rare that the primary motivator for an artist is money, which doesn't mean you don't need to eat food or sleep in a bed or wear clothing, right? So like, let's not bring that too far. It's not your primary motivator. That's fine. It doesn't mean money is evil, right? It's just neutral. Money, make sure money stays neutral to you and not goes over into being a negative thing. That's really important as a, just a mental frame. Money is a hammer, right? Like, you can build a house with a hammer, but you can also destroy a house with a hammer, right? Money is the tool that empowers the person using it, which is the whole reason that everything I do, my whole mission is about helping artists have more money. It's not like, I obviously don't believe money is evil. I think artists are doing such wonderful work in the world and doing the work that will change the world, that I know they will do more of that work and have more longevity with it if they have money. So like, you have to be careful not to start attributing evil to money. You have to just keep it neutral. So that's fine. It's just a tool, like a paintbrush. But I think it's also really important to note that when you are making decisions, so back to the idea that it's not probably your primary motivator, but it can be a factor among several, right? And it should, right? Because you should be paid for your work, I'm here to say. And I think it's really important to note that if it's not your primary motivator, then that will probably get reflected in your numbers. And again, this is a neutral, not a negative, right? This is a neutral thing. So if you're always going to make a decision to go for the more expensive materials so that your paintings look incredible, then that's probably going to show up on your profit and loss statement as expenses that are a little higher than they would be if you were just trying to make maximum dollar, maximum profit from selling that thing. And it is 100% fine that you make that choice. In fact, I don't know a single artist who wouldn't make that choice. But then when you look at those numbers, they're going to show that a little bit, right? They're going to show that you made a decision to spend more and not to totally make money the one and only thing, right? If money was the one and only thing, that balance sheet, that profit and loss statement, it would look probably a little better, right?
Yep.
But I think it can be humiliating and embarrassing for an artist to then look just at the numbers where it's not also showing like your amazing work with all that gorgeous paint in it. When you look at just the numbers, it's only going to show that one thing. And then suddenly you feel judged, right? You feel like, oh, this is showing me how money is not motivating me even at all. This is reflecting back to me all those choices compounded over the last year. And, you know, if you look at an accountant who looks at that and they say nasty things to you, like that one did to me and they make it mean something, it can feel awful, right? But I just want to say that, you know, the numbers are going to show stuff. Numbers are kind of objective in that way, and it can be painful to look at them, but they're not showing how awesome that show was you made, you know?
Oh, be still my heart. Thank you. you know, if I do nothing else with this podcast, it really is my mission to use it to try and put back some of the energy drain and self-confidence drain that artists have felt through the years dealing with people like that, who just want to stomp them because they're bullies or they don't get it. And the artist is left feeling diminished. So thank you for doing that, for putting that back in there. That's what we need.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now, looking at taxes, what about estimateds? Because my accountant started talking about estimateds this year. And I thought, you know, where's the threshold for that? Is there a point at which you have to start making estimated taxes? And when is that?
Sure. So the good news is there's a really clear moment. If your tax bill last year was over $1,000. So let's just remind ourselves what that means. I don't mean your whole taxes for all of last year were over $1,000. I mean your tax bill. So your bill is like the amount you hadn't prepaid during the year. That means you had to reconcile an amount of unpaid taxes that was greater than $1,000. That's what it means to have a tax bill, right? Because if you have a day job, for example, and you have money being withheld through a paycheck, say you're a teaching artist at a university and you have a paycheck, you're prepaying some of your taxes through that, right? The IRS doesn't care. You might have several hoses pointed towards the US Treasury paying taxes. One might be you making a manual estimated payment. One might be your W-2. One might be your spouse's W-2. Because if you're married filing jointly, you are one single tax unit, not two. So if last year's tax bill was $1,000, and yes, that does include your spouse if you're married filing joint. So this gets muddy because we're layering all the things in your whole scenario together on top of each other. If the tax bill goes over $1,000, now you do have to pay estimated quarterly taxes. And there's a reason for that. The reason, basically, the function of estimated quarterly taxes are to prepay your tax for the current year. They are to pay your taxes as you go, instead of getting hit with that enormous, unthinkable full annual tax bill, which is possible to get hit with if you're self-employed, because nobody takes taxes out for you when you're self-employed. So that's the role and purpose of estimated quarterly taxes. They are to pay as you go throughout the year in quarterly chunks to break up your taxes into four payments instead of one, so that you don't get hit with that, you know, $10,000 unexpected tax bill at the end of the year. That's the painful thing that estimated taxes are trying to keep you out of.
So if you don't do them, you get a penalty?
You do, in fact, yes. So you get up to four penalties and daily interest. So on each of the four, there's four quarterly tax deadlines. Google is right here for you. Google will tell you when they are, but they're April 15th, June 15th, September 15th, and January 15th. If you owe taxes quarterly, then when one of those dates passes by and no payment has come in from you, that means you'll get a penalty. So if you miss the first one, but then catch up on the next three, you'll only have one penalty and not four. If you miss all four, you'll have four penalties, right? So the incentive is like, you know, better to figure it out and keep up than to just be like, oh, I messed up, so I'll just completely stay messed up and not fix it. It's like, no, go ahead and fix it. And then daily interest is accrued on your unpaid balance. So daily interest on $1,000 for 365 days is not going to be a ton of money. Daily interest on $20,000 is going to be a lot of money. And the whole incentive with daily interest is better to make your payment today than tomorrow. Literally, it will cost you less today. It'll save you one more day of interest than to pay tomorrow. So you discover in the middle of two tax deadlines, oh shoot, I should have made a payment. Don't wait till the next deadline. Pay now, pay today. That's the incentive.
So it sounds like it's not that complicated as far as making the payment. You just can probably fill out a form, print it out if you want to do it even on paper and just mail in a check if you're not going to do it electronically.
You can absolutely do that. And if you owe quarterly taxes, typically what's going to happen is your tax return will print vouchers right on the front. And so if you see vouchers on the front of your tax return, that is about as close to an engraved invitation as you're ever going to get from the IRS. that is saying you owe these and go ahead and pay them. And it actually has the amounts pre-printed and the dates. So that's pretty good. So print those out, mail the check, that's fine. If you prefer, you can go to IRS Direct Pay and pay online. And that's completely fine. It's pretty easy, really.
So if you received a refund on a particular year, you got a tax refund, then it's safe to say that you don't the next year have to pay estimateds. Am I correct then?
You're not legally required to. Yes.
Okay. Because that's mm-hmm. where there have been times where I've gotten a refund and my accountant's like, oh, you know, if you want to pay an estimated next year, but he's been vague about when and why and how much I would need to pay. So mm-hmm. I think he's just trying to be helpful, but it doesn't give me an idea of, well, do I need to do this? Should I be doing this? Is it going to put me on some kind of list of being flagged now that I'm volunteering to start this process? You know?
Yeah. It is scary and it is complicated. And I have never found an accountant who explains it very well because it takes a lot of time. There's a lot of moving parts to it. But the idea is that estimated quarterly taxes exist so that you can prepay taxes when you are incurring income that doesn't have any withholding. So it's not just self-employed people who can get in this boat. Like we self-employed people and artists, you are self-employed. Like we count as this. It's not just us who make income that's not taxed. So when I sell a painting, nobody took taxes out of that. That counts as like, you know, money I should be making estimated payments on. But other people can be in this boat. Farmers are in this boat. Farmers have to make estimated payments. Fishermen have to make estimated payments. Property owners, like landlords, right? The rent checks that you get as income, those don't have taxes withheld. So this system exists for a whole bunch of different kinds of taxpayers, including you. And the whole thing is that you are the one who knows what's happening this year. Your accountant isn't going to know until tax time. So you can let your accountant tell you after the whole year has gone by, oh, hey, you owe $20,000. Or you could get on top of it and prepay some of that $20,000 so that when you talk to your accountant, they're like, you only owe $900. That's so much nicer. That's a better position to be in.
It is. So, it is. Thank you. And that's really important to be getting all of this decoded information. One of the reasons I'm using this accountant, he's across state lines actually, but he handles this state as well. So we do everything electronically, is he is comfortable working with sales that are online. So my course is virtual. Mm-hmm. Is that something that needs to be approached entirely differently? How do you find an accountant that's comfortable handling something like that, where you're looking at sales of an online product that's not mm-hmm. necessarily a physical product?
Yeah.
Because that put me off for a long time.
Yeah. And I understand. And it's very complicated and scary. So what you're talking about now, we're moving away from income tax. And now we're talking about sales tax.
Okay.
Something very important to know is that sales tax is a completely different system. Like, I know everybody is like, oh no.
Sorry, listeners. Everything's still okay.
So I can confidently sit here and talk about federal income tax, because all of you, if you're a US taxpayer, are in the same boat. And then state income tax law generally flows from the federal. So state rules, even though they'll vary, and you know, the Georgia flavor is going to be quite different from the Massachusetts flavor, they'll still generally follow federal rules with some small exceptions. So that's income tax. Sales tax, totally different. Sales tax is a state and local based tax. And there are 9,998 different sales tax jurisdictions in the United States.
Wow.
Just shy of 10,000. So I can't be on a podcast and say one word about sales tax that will apply to all of you. You will all have something different. And you really have to check with someone local. So that's really important. Online sales are a beast because the laws have not caught up with
I noticed that
we actually do commerce these days, and they act as though, you know, we're all still like operating in 1930, like where all your shop at or in your neighborhood. And so like, it would be rare that you'd cross county lines. And like, now you're like buying stuff all across the country and the world all the time. So sales and local tax gets complicated.
Thank you, though. I'm wondering if there's a place that people can look to at least find an accountant. Is there some database of, I mean, I picked mine out because he said he would basically address it. He was not afraid. A lot of them were like, yeah, I don't really know about that. He was willing to go into those waters. So is there a place people should look to know they're getting someone that is not going to send them in the wrong direction?
Yeah, that's great. First of all, hang on to your accountant because that's a good one. That's rare. A lot of accountants will be really happy to deal with your income tax and not touch sales tax. So that's,
yeah, he's brave.
Yeah, give him a give him some flowers. I do have a resource for people that is just a good place to start. This isn't going to find you an accountant, but it is a good place to at least start getting your head around what sales tax you might actually owe. There is a company called TaxJar. Now, TaxJar is a software. They sell software that helps you handle sales tax and sales tax return filings. You may find, I mean, by all means, look up their software. And if it works for you, use it. It's great. As the last time I priced out all the different sales tax softwares, it was the least expensive and it's a good product. But even if you never buy their product, they have a blog, the TaxJar blog, and it's excellent. So I highly recommend going to that website because you can do a state-by-state lookup and you can start parsing out what the nexus rules might be in your state because nexus rules vary across every state. One state has internet nexus, the next state does not. So I can't tell you what the rules are because literally every one of you listening is going to be in a different place with a different rule. So
thank you.
Yeah, the TaxJar blog. It's really good. And I trust them because they base their whole company around accurate sales tax information. So I go there to just check up on the rules.
That's great. And I'll link to that in the show notes, as well as to you and all of your information.
I have like a free visual guide to artist tax deductions. It is like, I spent so much time with a designer making it like graphically understandable. It's colored like in rainbow colors. It's beautiful. If you want to put that in your show notes and people can download that, it's one page printable and they can stick it up by their desk and like do their bookkeeping with it.
I would be happy to put that in there. I'll be sure to do it.
Awesome.
And thank you for that. And I would love for you to wrap us up. I appreciate so much your time today. It's an absolute honor to get to speak with you. You give so much to the art community through your services and the world with your art.
Thank you.
You're welcome. If you could wrap us up with your best advice for our artists out there who would like to start making money with their art.
I think one, acknowledging the toxicity of that artist stereotype and making sure you get it out of there. Realizing that you are always going to be your own best representative. And I'm not saying don't work with galleries, no, but just you are still always going to be the best representative for your work and that you're giving meta messages about your work all the time. So be more aware maybe of what those are. So treating yourself like you're a real professional is helpful, not just getting a gallery, not just working with other people and making them feel more confident in the quality of your work, but it's actually really helpful on your taxes. So remember that having a profit motive is the thing that entitles you to be able to take expenses because hobbyists don't get expenses. So be a professional, recognize that a profit motive is in fact your safety net when it comes to your taxes. So it's okay to just be cool with it. And I just think as a service, like all artists should really try not to work for free and make their prices too low because it doesn't just hurt you, it hurts all of us. And I think better treatment in general for artists is important so we don't get these hobby loss audits. Like it's a macro problem that we can chip away at the individual level. So all of us treating ourselves with more personal, professional respect, like the genuine small business that you are. That's helpful to you and it's helpful to all of us.
This wraps up my interview with American artist and tax expert to creative entrepreneurs, Hannah Cole. I hope the interview has brought you tons of inspiration for your art and encouragement to tackle some of the sometimes intimidating business elements of your art career, like taxes. Taking one piece at a time, it's really not that bad. And the more you keep up with it, the easier it gets. Don't forget to check out my new online portrait course, The Portrait Code, with modules in design, composition, color theory, anatomy, perspective, mixing skin tones, and confidence included. It's everything I wished I could find in one complete online painting course. Learn more at PassionatePainterAcademy.com. Until next time, go make something.